Would you bow your heads once more, please? God of grace and glory, hidden sometimes from eyes that expect to see you only in designated places, like this place, make it possible for us to see you in all places. And even in this place, make it possible for us to escape the prison of self, that dungeon which holds all of us in some measure of bondage. Help us remember that most basic word of the gospel, that finding our life means losing it, and that losing it means investing it in something other than private ambition, means discovering joy in what the world around us may not have time for, a moment of grateful meditation at sunrise, an awareness through each day that someone near us needs a kind word, a silent prayer at sunset that we have made life harder for no one that day. The world is more filled than ever with cleverness, but more starved than ever for compassion, overrun with entertainment and hurting for warmth and kindness, gorged on hype and hungry for what is real. Remind us that we are committed by our profession of faith to make a difference in such a world. Help us consider how we can do it as we continue our prayer a moment more in silence.
Good morning. My name is Tom Neal. I welcome you here to University Congregational Church this morning. Members and visitors alike, we're especially glad to see you. I guess I should say at this point, for those of you who were here earlier in the summer, I'm not back by popular demand. They're asking me to do it until I get it complete and right. If you are a visitor, we ask that you sign the guest card that's in the pew rack in front of you. If there is not a card, if you would sign the bulletin and leave it on the pew when you leave, we may then be able to acknowledge your presence. There are no special announcements other than to say that the newsletter did not get out. There was a computer problem. I trust that it will be in the mail early this week, and I apologize for that. Will the ushers please come forward? If the beauty of this church and its people and the good work they do in this community make you glad, we invite you now to give it your willing support.
Thank you.
our gift this morning and the use made of it by this church show that we love others, not only with our lips, but also with our lives. Amen.
Glory be to the Father.
Among many welcome visitors this morning, members of the Packer family, I baptized this morning the 8th grandchild, I think it is, of Alice Packer, a beautiful little girl named Anne Elizabeth. We're happy to have them and friends visiting them and any of the rest of you who are here for the first time or second or third. I would like to remind you to take a look at the announcement about the new member inquirers class, which is scheduled to be held right over here after the service this morning. The sermon this morning is my second response to a question about holy war, that special kind of fighting in which the soldier is convinced God is on his side and will help him exterminate the enemy. I mentioned last week that the book of Joshua, a veritable encyclopedia of holy war, describes the Hebrew conquest of Palestine as if it were a blitzkrieg, lightning fast. Archaeology finds evidence that it was not that way at all, that it was much slower, drawn out over 200 years, which is more the way Judges, the book we are examining this morning, describes it. It's rather curious, having one Bible document correct another, but this is not the only time it happens in this book with human fingerprints all over it. Joshua makes the Semitic invaders invincible, but Judges is much more realistic about how often the enemy won and how some of them simply could not be driven out at all. Since they were not all driven out, despite having their God Yahweh on their side, some explanation had to be made. You can find three different ones in these two books of bloody battles. In one place, it's because the tribes are not obedient. In another, it's because some of the native population needed to be kept alive in order to keep the land from going to waste and ruin, there not being enough of the invaders to take care of that. And in still another place, another version, which is as revolting as anything you will read in any literature in the world, we are told that some of the native population was left by the Lord so that Israelites who had not fought before could practice on the enemies that were left alive. Guinea pigs by the will of the Hebrew God Yahweh. It's as if Custer had won the battle of the Little Bighorn and then deliberately left some of the Indians alive so that new cavalry recruits could learn how to kill them. The unfortunate king who is defeated in the very first battle described in the book of Judges has his thumbs and his big toes cut off by the warriors of the Hebrew God, who know that if you lose your thumbs, it's almost impossible to handle a weapon. And if you lose your big toes, you can't march or run very well. It's a quaint old custom for putting your enemies out of business. Since this primitive God never rebukes his army for mutilating a defeated foe, we have to assume that he rejoices, like them, in humiliating the enemy. There is occasional crude humor in these stories, told for generations around campfires And one example is found in the story of a judge of Israel named Ehud. Now, I must tell you that these men were not judges, as you and I understand that word. They might better be described as heroes who rose from time to time to deliver Israel from her enemies. Ehud was one of these. And the trick by which he killed an enemy king must have been cause for loud laughter each time the tribes heard it. It seems that Ehud delivered a ransom to the king who was dominating Israel at that time, and then got the king to dismiss his bodyguards by saying, "I have a message for you from God." When the king, whom the story rather gratuitously describes as fat, stood to receive the message, perhaps for all we know, standing in some degree of reverence at least, or somebody else's God, Ehud plunged a sword so deep into his belly that even the handle disappeared. Now, why record such a detail except to guarantee a few extra chuckles around the campfire? But a bigger laugh lies just ahead. The Israelite judge who does the killing runs out of the room and locks the door so that when the bodyguards come back, they are uncertain what to do. Should they disturb their king or not? They stand about waiting because they think their king must have gone to the bathroom. But after a while, they conclude something must be wrong. And so they rush in, only to find him dead, tricked by one of the heroes of the Hebrew God, Yahweh. Yahweh, you understand, is the Hebrew name which we translate in English as Lord. And how the tribes must have loved the story of the way an enemy general died one day at the hands of, guess what, a woman. To these patriarchal male chauvinists, no man could possibly die a more degrading death than that. And how nice it was to think that it had happened to their enemy. The woman's name was Jael. And by the kind of deception that was considered all right in the name of her God, she lulled the exhausted general to sleep in her tent and then picked up a tent peg and a mallet and drove the peg through his head. It's not enough to rejoice in the thought of a great general dying at the hands of a woman. The story is interrupted by a long and very ancient piece of Hebrew poetry, which prolongs the fun by picturing the general's mother back at home, trying to reassure herself that her son is still alive. The poem rejoices at her pain, and the closing line hopes that all the enemies of the Lord will suffer the same fate. Pleasant story. I do not mean to suggest that these chosen people were any worse than most of their enemies. It's just that as the people of the Lord, you tend to think they might be a little better. But their cruelties were done in His name in the same way their enemies called upon their own God. The Moabites, for example, who lived next door, served a god named Chemosh, who fought for them just as Yahweh fought for the tribes of Israel. We know this for sure because about 100 years ago, archaeologists discovered the famous Moabite stone, a hunk of black basalt, 4 feet high, a couple of feet wide, and over a foot thick, which tells in its inscriptions how the god Chemosh was drunk with joy at the slaughter of the Israelites in a great Moabite victory. Have you ever tried to imagine reading sacred history from a Moabite point of view? It would, quite frankly, sound a great deal like Joshua and Judges, and we'd be appalled by it because it would be somebody else's sacred book and not ours. But it's one of the strangest of all these so-called judges that I really want to talk about, a person famous in art and opera and Hollywood movies. According to the Hebrew story, his birth was announced by a divine messenger, which leads us to suppose at first that he will be a leader of noble faith and special wisdom. But when we read about his adult life, he turns out to be a mass murderer, a liar, an inveterate womanizer, a torturer of helpless animals, a lout, and a bully. We first meet this Samson as a grown-up, telling his mom and dad that he has seen a Philistine girl whom he wants and that they should get her for him. They are not happy that he wants a girl from the enemy side, but what they do not know, we are told, is that this is actually the Lord's doing, who is, quote, seeking an occasion, unquote, against the Philistines, because at the moment they have his people in subjection. It's what the CIA might call provoking an incident, hardly the sort of undercover operation any of us would want to blame on the all-powerful God of the universe. On his way to claim this Philistine girl, Samson is attacked by a lion and promptly tears it to pieces with his bare hands. I first read that under another title, Tarzan of the Apes. And Sunday school kids always come alive when this part of the story is told, although they think of Superman, perhaps, and not Tarzan. Later, at a banquet with 30 friends, Samson proposes a riddle, saying, if you get it, in the next 7 days, I'll give each one of you 2 new Hickey Freeman suits. They huddle together and guess away without any luck. So they go to Samson's wife of the moment and tell her that if she doesn't give them the answer, they'll burn her father's house and her along with it. So she goes to Samson in tears and says, you don't love me. You just hate me. You told my friends a riddle and you didn't tell me what it means. Samson says, look, I haven't even told my father and mother. Why should I tell you? So she resorts to a familiar weapon and cries through the whole 7 days of the party, which put quite a damper on it for Samson, who finally gives in and tells her the answer to the riddle. When the 30 guests, getting it from her, solved the riddle, you might think Samson would say, hey, you cheated by enlisting my wife, so I don't have to keep my promise. No new clothes for you. But logic doesn't always prevail in some of these stories, and so instead he does something more like a mafia hitman than a savior anointed by the Lord. The spirit of that God comes upon him, we are told, and under its influence he goes to a Philistine city nearby and kills 30 strangers, steals their clothing, and comes back to make good on his promise. You would think that if he had to kill someone, it would be the guys who deceived him, but instead he knocks off 30 others who, so far as we are told, are completely innocent of any wrong. Except, and this is what would make the story hilarious to the tribes, except that the 30 strangers are Philistines. And who cares how many Philistines get killed? In most of this history, the only good Philistine is a dead Philistine. Any form of cruelty, as a matter of fact, even to the most innocent, is okay so long as it does some damage to those same Philistines. There was the day when our hero caught 300 foxes, tied them together tail to tail, strapped a burning torch between each pair, and turned them loose to run wild with pain through the standing grain fields of the hated enemy. Now, if you have ever tried to catch a single fox, you may guess that this story is probably either fictitious or grossly exaggerated, but that's beside the point, at least the point I want to make, which is that Samson's God does not break in to say, hold on a minute, favored son of mine, don't you think this carries things a bit far? Someday, I know in my omniscience, there's going to be a society for the prevention of cruelty to animals, and this story is going to make both of us look bad. And he doesn't intervene, I would argue, because this primitive God, listen carefully, bears no real relation to any God most of us would want to worship, or to the God revealed by Jesus of Nazareth. Some of you will remember another episode in Samson's life when he picked up the fresh jawbone of an ass and whacked 1,000 Philistines to death with it. It would have taken a while. Now, perhaps we shouldn't take this too seriously because the author sums up this story in a little poem filled with outrageous puns. Students of Hebrew and Greek know that the Bible is full of puns. But James Moffat is about the only translator I know who really tries to bring them across into English. And so you will know how much fun the author of this book was having with the story of Samson. I will give you the four short lines of Hebrew poetry as Moffat translates them into English, keeping the puns, keeping the play on words that is in the original language. Now listen, I'll try to indicate lines. With the jawbone of an ass, I have piled them in a mass. With the jawbone of an ass, I have assailed assailants. Period. I wonder sometimes if people who think the Bible was dictated word by word by God himself would be puzzled by his sense of humor if they knew all the jokes that lie hidden beneath our English translations. Surely they would. But that's another topic. Back to Samson. Our bonny hero goes down one day to Gaza. You hear about it frequently in the news. Goes down to Gaza to visit a prostitute in an enemy city. The local folk hear about it and surround the place so they can kill him in the morning. But he slips out at midnight, pulls up the enormous gates of the city and their two pillars, puts them on his shoulder, gate and pillars, and strolls off 40 miles to Hebron. Once he's rested up, he falls for still another woman whose name you will recognize, Delilah. She is promptly bribed, he did not have good luck with his wives, by 5 Philistine kings to find out what makes Samson so strong, such a dreaded enemy of theirs. When Samson lies to her 3 times in a row, she finally says, "How can you say you love me and keep making such a fool of me?" And the story says she kept nagging day after day until an exhausted Samson broke down and told her the truth, that if his hair were cut, he would be as weak as anybody else. Delilah promptly sends for the 5 kings who had bribed her, lulls Samson to sleep in her lap, calls in the neighboring barber to cut off the locks of his hair. Would you like to guess how many locks there were? You can do it. 7, of course. It had to be 3 or 7. He might have looked real strange with 3. 7, because that's the inevitable Jewish number for perfection. Well, with the hair gone, the Philistines happily handcuff their old nemesis, gouge his eyes out in the gentle ways people had, take him back to Gaza, and put him to work grinding grain at a mill like some huge dumb animal. You know the rest, surely. How his hair grows back, how no Philistine seemed to notice that it was growing back, and how one day he is ordered to perform at a great banquet in honor of the Philistine god Dagon. He reaches out blindly to get his hands on the pillars of the temple, pushes them over, and brings 3,000 men and women screaming down to their deaths. Surely some of those people must have been far more innocent than Samson. But it didn't matter. They were Philistines, and we are solemnly assured that the God of the Hebrews was always looking for some opportunity to wipe them out. The story ends with a grimly appropriate epitaph for this divinely announced assassin. The epitaph reads, "Samson killed more people at his death than he had killed during his life." The tribes, I'm sure, applauded that line about their bully boy Rambo, but we can only wonder about a man whose birth was announced by God, the story tells us, as if he were a second Moses or a prophet like Samuel or Jesus of Nazareth much later, and whose claim to fame, whose epitaph is that he managed to kill more people in his last moment than he had killed during his entire life. This is the stuff of legend, dear friends, don't confuse the God of Samson with the God of love and mercy described by the great Jewish prophets Hosea and Micah and Isaiah later on, and by Jesus, born a Jew, whom we worship in this house. Read the library we call the Bible, written over a period of 1,000 years as a record of the evolution of religion, and it will be less dangerous and make far more sense. Next week, a story which was once in our Bible and then dropped out, but which has, I think, a far better claim to being there than the story you have just heard. Please come back and see if you agree, and please come back and convince me that it is not my announcement of these topics a week ahead of time that empties the pews.